This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Okay, we are going to have a special about Russia, Ukraine, and we're going to get into that in a moment. But before we do that, I realize this is a special. Before we do that, I actually have a bit of breaking news that may shock you. It may shock you. You might want to sit down. Maybe you're at the airport on your iPad. Maybe you're at home. I'm just asking, please sit down before I break this to you. Okay, you ready for this? Every war isn't World War II. I know it may be a lot to take in, but allow me to say it one more time. Every war isn't World War II. And every time a conflict breaks out, we don't have to view it through the lens of World War II. Every bad guy isn't Hitler. Every good guy isn't Churchill. Everybody who wants a peace deal of some kind isn't Neville Chamberlain. And I know people educated in America's education system and people who watch the American media or listen to American politicians on both sides, I understand how absolutely earth-shattering what I just told you must be. But on my life, there were wars forever before World War II. I'm serious. There was even a World War I, I promise. There were wars forever before World War II, and there have been wars after World War II. I'm not even kidding. So why am I being a complete smart aleck here? Because I constantly see when we discuss Russia, Ukraine, the loss of 1.5 million lives, that's what they say. 1.5 million, just to give you a frame of reference there, that's more than the total loss of life in every conflict in the history of the United States of America, including the Civil War. That's how large that number is. But every time I see Russia, Ukraine brought up, I continually hear things like this.
We want to be able to support Ukraine for as long as it takes.
We will collectively stand with Ukraine for as long as it takes.
So make no mistake, we will support Ukraine's self-defense for as long as it takes.
Freedom is priceless. It's worth fighting for as long as it takes. And that's how long we're going to be with you, Mr. President, for as long as it takes.
We'll do it.
Thank you.
As long as it takes. And listen, what I'm about to say may very well offend you. It may, but we all need to talk about this here. Most wars, almost every single war in the history of the world, it's the end of a political disagreement of some kind. That famous von Clausewitz line, war is a continuation of politics by other means. It's true. So wars break out because politics, diplomacy has broken down in some way. Somebody will attack someone else first, yes. And after the fighting has gone on for some time, especially if the war has kind of ground to a halt with nothing else happening, two sides, they come together and they agree, let's make peace. And the winning side, you know, historically, if we're talking in the ancient world even, we'll talk Roman days. The winning side, hey, I won this battle and that battle and you can't field any more armies. The winning side will obviously get the more favorable deal. And the losing side will have to give things up. You need to pay me this much in gold. You need to take this part of your territory, which I want or which I fought over, and you're going to have to give up a piece of that. But you sign a peace agreement, and the war ends. If you, and again, I know this may be breaking news for people, but territories especially, they change hands all the time. Alsace-Lorraine, I'll let you do your own research on that. Go ahead and look up, it's one of a million examples I could use. Go ahead and look up Alsace-Lorraine. Is it French? Is it German? Well, I don't know. What day of the week is it? Because things change all the time. But what has happened in the United States of America, and globally, I'm not just putting this on, you know, us Americans, we Americans, I don't know, I went to community college. What has happened here in the world is we view everything through the lens of World War II. And we view everything through the lens of, no matter what, Captain America wins in the end. I actually heard, I kid you not, I heard Justin Trudeau, PM of Canada, come out and say, Ukraine will win because Ukraine is on the right side. Captain America is a work of fiction, and that's not how real life works at all. Sometimes the side you want to win wins, sometimes the side you want to lose, they win. That's how it goes. It's uncomfortable, but it's a fact. So that begs the question, why Ukraine? And we're going to get into this with Mike Benz. I know you love Mike Benz. We have him on as often as we can. We're going to get into this with Mike Benz here in a few minutes. But why this obsession with it? Have you ever sat back and wondered? I mean, no matter how you feel, I don't expect you to be a Russian fan, or maybe you are. I personally am not. But no matter how you feel about it, it's so far away. It's not here. We look domestically and we see all these problems. Inflation's still out of control. Savings has been drained. Record high credit card debt. Inflation is through the roof. The border's open. All these domestic things. And yet we are told repeatedly, not just by Democrats, by Republicans, especially the older establishment types, that the most important thing in the world is Ukraine.
Providing assistance for the Ukrainians to defeat the Russians. That's the number one priority for the United States right now, according to most Republicans. That's sort of how we see the challenges confronting the country at the moment.
Just think about that for a moment. When Mitch McConnell said that, he was the highest-ranking Republican in the United States Senate. In fact, he was by far the most powerful Republican in Washington, D.C., back when he said those words. All those problems I just laid out, and he stood up with a straight face and looked right into the camera and said, the most important thing in the world is Ukraine right now. It's almost odd, isn't it? It's almost as if there are a lot of very powerful forces highly, highly invested in keeping this slaughter going on without end. And you, of course, remember the meeting, the diplomacy meeting heard around the world when Trump and J.D. Vance finally had enough of all this talk.
I'm talking about the kind of diplomacy that's going to end the destruction of your country.
Yes, but if you
Mr. President, with respect, I think it's disrespectful for you to come into the Oval Office and try to litigate this in front of the American media. Right now, you guys are going around and forcing conscripts to the front lines because you have manpower problems. You should be thanking the president for trying to bring it into this conflict.
Have you ever been to Ukraine that you say what problems we have?
I have been to...
Come once.
I've actually watched and seen the stories, and I know what happens is you bring people, you bring them on a propaganda tour, Mr. President.
You will feel it in the future.
You don't know that.
God bless. You will not have a war.
Don't tell us what we're going to feel. We're trying to solve a problem. Don't tell us what we're going to feel. You're not in a good position.
You don't have the
cards right now. With us, you start having
cards.
Playing cards. Right now, you don't. Yeah, you're playing cards.
I'm serious.
You're gambling with the lives of millions of people. You're gambling with World War III. You're gambling with World War III.
Have you said thank you once?
A lot of times.
No, in this
even
entire
today,
meeting, you said thank
even
you.
Even today.
You went to Pennsylvania and campaigned for the opposition in October. Oh. Offer some words of appreciation for the United States of America and the president who's trying to save your country.
Bizarre, wasn't it? Almost as if there's a commitment to keep this going without end. As long as it takes. We have to hear it over and over and over again. So allow me to once again, before we go to Mike Benz, and we're gonna really dig into Ukraine and the UK and the resources and East versus West. We're gonna tackle all this stuff. Allow me to once again give you the breaking news that I know for so many people will be stunning. Every conflict isn't World War II. Everybody who invades isn't Hitler. Everyone who wants peace isn't Neville Chamberlain. Everyone who wants to stand up and fight against the enemy isn't Winston Churchill. There have been a million wars in a million different places for a million different reasons. We, one, don't always have to get involved, and two, we should be highly, highly suspicious of anybody who doesn't want slaughter to end. Because there is one other thing that I seem to notice of everybody on the left and the right who believes that we should go on as long as it takes. It's the most important thing in the world. And that one thing they all share in common, none of them are doing the dying. Not one. 1.5 million lives lost. You can go look at the memorial in Ukraine. They have a little flag up for every soldier who's died. It's honestly one of the saddest things I've ever seen in my life. It's just fields of them. And not one of those people saying, as long as it takes, is represented by those flags. Interesting, isn't it? Let's talk to Mike Benz about Ukraine. What's really going on? And even if there is a peace deal, is it going to be permanent? Talk to Mike.
President Zelensky supposedly made a statement today in AP. I'm not a big fan of AP, so maybe it was an incorrect statement, but he said he thinks the war's going to go on for a long time. And he better not be right about that. That's all I'm saying.
I find this whole thing to be so incredibly bizarre, because why would you want that? And it definitely seems like he wants that. It seems like, well, even if Zelensky doesn't, that somebody wants this war to go on, which I find to be so incredibly odd, because it's awful. Just, look, 1.5 million dead is an estimate. That's just awful. I bet you Mike Benz knows a little bit about something, because he seems to know where all the bodies are buried around this planet. Joining me now, my friend Mike Benz, executive director for the Foundation for Freedom Online. If you're not following his work, you're kind of just out of the know on everything. Okay, Mike, for people, honestly, like me, it's very confusing, because it seems like a lot of people, not just Zelensky, obviously we know about Boris Johnson shooting down the deal. It seems like a lot of people want this thing to keep going forever. Can you help me understand it?
Well, that is the long-term plan. It's the seizing of all of Eurasia, and Ukraine is the gateway to that. It's the pivot point for the energy geopolitics of Europe. It's a major boon to the military contractors. It's a major boon to the banks who do the development and financing and the reconstruction. But essentially, this story dates back to 2014, when the U.S. and U.K. governments organized a coup in Ukraine, and they were not expecting the upshot of that, which was the counter-coup that led to the breakaway of the Donbass, the eastern part of Ukraine, as well as Crimea. And during that process, the breakaway led to the loss of territory, or territorial control, of the puppet government in Ukraine. That started with the removal of Yanukovych in 2014, it then proceeded leadership-wise to Yatsenyuk, Poroshenko, and then Zelensky. Now Zelensky is the heir apparent to the Western war in Ukraine. And the issue is they lost control over the eastern part of the state, where all the energy resources are. They lost control over Crimea, which is the major warm water port and essentially the key to power over the Black Sea. And this war will not end, whether there's a peace deal struck or not, until, in NATO's mind, until that territory is reacquired one way or another.
Okay, so walk me through this just briefly. Sorry, Mike, I need you to dumb it down for me. So there was Ukraine. Ukraine had a government. The Obama administration decided they wanted that government removed because they wanted access to energy and things like that. And so after that removal, then what? Russia lost the energy that they wanted, and it went into Ukraine's possession?
Ukraine did. So what happened was while much of the population is in the West, most of the resources are in the East. And the eastern half of the country, Ukraine has always been split almost 50-50 between its Ukrainian ethnic half and its Russian ethnic half. The Russian ethnic half, obviously, in the east, closer to Russia, the Ukrainian ethnic half predominantly in the west, closer to the EU. And the issue was when the coup happened, there was a counter coup when the eastern half of Ukraine, closer to Russia, decided they would not respect the new Kiev government, the one that was installed by Victoria Nuland and Jeff Pyatt and the Barack Obama State Department. Now, part of this was because part of the terms of the new government installed by the U.S. and U.K. there in Ukraine was the banning of the Russian language. So you can imagine what it must have felt like for the entire eastern half of the country to not be able to speak the tongue in which they communicate with their grandmothers, to be able to communicate their messages on media or social media or on radio or in print. There was effectively a, you know, a denazification, if you will, except done to Russian influence in a half-Russian country. And so you can imagine how that half felt. They did not respect the Kiev government. They declared themselves a breakaway state. That is what set the stage for the Russiagate targeting of Donald Trump and Paul Manafort and Rudy Giuliani over their ties to Ukraine. Paul Manafort had been working with Viktor Yanukovych, which was the exact government that was couped out. This is part of the tentacles of how they strung together this fake Russiagate situation. But the fact is the plan was to reacquire that territory. That was what the military assistance was for in 2019 that Trump was impeached over potentially holding up. Why were we giving military assistance to Ukraine years before there was an actual war in Ukraine? Well, it was because there was always a war in Ukraine after 2014, and it was a NATO war to reacquire that territory. After NATO forces killed over 15,000 Russian ethnic Ukrainians in the eastern part of the state, Russia stepped in to militarily backstop those Russian ethnic Ukrainians, and in the process, militarily occupied this territory. And The whole situation here with Trump's peace deal is that NATO knows that they're losing this war with Russia. The attempts to economically bankrupt Russia have backfired since China has stepped in and backstopped, basically redirected the energy supplies. Also, there's just tons of smuggled and laundered Russian oil and gas still flowing into the EU. So they haven't cut them off economically, which means they haven't cut them off militarily. And Ukraine continues to bleed territory. So NATO now, I think, is actually broadly supportive of the concept of a peace deal that that Trump is aggressively pushing. I think the discrepancy is what are the terms of the deal. Trump believes that Ukraine is going to need to cede territory and reopen itself to elections. NATO wants neither of those things to happen, but may feel forced to do so because the U.S. provides 70% of the funding for NATO. So, you know, the magic card in the back of the sleeve of the White House is if NATO pushes too hard against the plan, they cut funding for NATO, and then suddenly NATO's no longer.
Mike, help me understand, or maybe I don't know how you feel about this. We haven't talked about it off camera, but help me understand why we continue to need NATO at all. I understand why it was formed and whatnot, but it seems like more of a creator of wars now than a preventer of wars. But am I looking at that wrong?
You're exactly right. This is NATO never fired a single bullet from 1949 to 1995. It was actually never had to defend a NATO country for the entire from a territorial attack the entire time that it's existed. I believe it was only invoked one time, and that was right after 9/11. But they never exactly fingered who it was who did the attack. These were, we're told, 19 hijackers with mostly Saudi passports. We didn't exactly invade Saudi Arabia after 9/11. But the fact is NATO became an offensive weapon when it lost its defensive purpose. NATO offensively bombed Serbia and Yugoslavia for 78 days straight in the process of removing Slobodan Milosevic. NATO unilaterally attacked Libya to remove Muammar Gaddafi. NATO unilaterally attacked Afghanistan. And, you know, this is the purpose of NATO, is to put bullets and military kinetic force behind the economic battering ram of the EU and the IMF and the World Bank. This is it's effectively the fail-safe. If the State Department can't get it done through negotiations, if sanctions can't get it done through economically pressuring foreign countries, if the CIA boys and the MI6 boys can't get it done with covert action and regime change coups. That leaves you with the hard power of NATO to get it done by sending in the Marines, so to speak. So that has been the function of NATO. It is the, you know, it's the trump card, effectively, in the back sleeve of every ambassador and executive branch authority of NATO countries, that if a foreign government doesn't do what they say, at the end of the day, they always have NATO to go in and literally military coup them out of office. But NATO has now evolved because of its, and frankly, it's been doing this almost since its existence. Folks are familiar with Operation Gladio. Political sabotage and political subterfuge has always been part and parcel of NATO operations. The political control over the internal politics of countries in NATO and beyond has been part of the civil military branch of NATO. This is something that every military has, this need to achieve civilian aims in order to get military advantage. And this is now coming home to roost. NATO's played a major, if not the major, role in internet censorship from the Trump election in 2016 on to present day. They've played a major role in political sabotage. And right now we're seeing a strange situation emerge with the conflict between the U.S. and EU over free speech, something that we've been told for decades has distinguished EU countries from authoritarian countries like Russia and China. You have a situation where European countries are arresting 10 to 100 times more of their own citizens than Russia is for speech online. And so J.D. Vance and the White House have been trying to get the EU to cancel this new legislation called the EU Digital Services Act. It's the Digital Censorship Act, and imposes hundreds of millions of dollars worth of fines on U.S. Social media platforms if they don't censor effectively what NATO calls disinformation. And the trump card that's held by the White House is if the EU doesn't get rid of this, and NATO has been pushing this censorship law, maybe we need to renegotiate our posture in NATO. And that is where I think things are currently headed, unless the EU reverses course.
Pause right there. We will be right back talking to more Mike Benz. I want to rewind on something. It's going to sound like I'm sidetracking, and maybe I am, but you mentioned MI6. We can get to the CIA. What is MI6 now, Mike? I mean, we all know James Bond, right? But that's clearly just a movie. What are they now? Are they this mega powerful, invasive juggernaut with eyes and ears everywhere? Are they just kind of this floundering intelligence agency that was once... What are they now?
Well, they are the intelligence arm of the UK Foreign Office, their version of the State Department. They are the, you know, political warfare arm of British statecraft. And it was the inspiration, really, for the CIA. If you read the Inauguration of Organized Political Warfare in 1948 by George Kennan, the same guy who would go on to create the plausible deniability doctrine for the CIA and authorize them to do political black ops, in that memo that preceded NSC 10-2, creating plausible deniability, Kennan made the argument that if we don't have our own version of a British intelligence organized political warfare version, then we will not have the American century in the 20th century. If we don't rule the world, Britain will use its statecraft capacities to, or the Bolsheviks will. This was the argument that was being made in 1948. And so It was the inspiration. Much of American statecraft is modeled on British statecraft, and the two have a special relationship, intelligence sharing. They work constantly together. We saw our own CIA and FBI counterintelligence working with British intelligence during the Russiagate affair. Folks remember the Steele dossier was named after Christopher Steele, the former MI6 agent who started his own private intelligence firm. You see this happen constantly. For example, if you go to NATO STRATCOM Center of Excellence, that's the Strategic Communications Wing of NATO, Strategic communications, according to their own definition, includes information operations and psychological operations. So this is NATO's PSYOP arm, literal PSYOP arm. And what they talk about is propping up institutions like the Integrity Initiative, which was run out of, we're told, a Scottish charity that had an office in London. It received over £2 million from the UK Foreign Office. It was supported by NATO's political committee as well. It was run by Chris O'Donnell, the former MI6 operative, was also participating. Richard Dearlove, the former head of MI6, and the Integrity Initiative was a globe-spanning British intelligence operation. It was run by, again, current and former intelligence officers of British statecraft, and in those inner UK cluster cells there were Nina Jankovic, who would go on years later to become the head of the Disinformation Governance Board at DHS. It's one big conjoined blob in that sense. They had a US branch office as well. They recruited cluster cell members from every NATO country. They deliberately recruited, in their own terms, members of the military, members of financial and regulatory oversight bodies, members of the journalism class, cultural influencers. They even had in these leaked documents detailed success write-ups of how they had sabotaged the political chances for different political candidates across the EU. For example, they had a whole army time code for how they sabotaged the nomination of Pedro Baños, the man who was nominated to be the effectively Minister of Defense in Spain, because they thought that he was too favorable to Russia. That was the predicate that they used to oust him. How they ran a whole covert Twitter campaign and then ran stories to the media, back-channeled with the UK embassy in Spain and the Spanish embassy in the UK to run it directly up to the Prime Minister of Spain that he had to tank the nomination for who was going to be effectively their chief defense officer. And this was all while the Integrity Initiative documents instructed inner cluster cell members to be helpfully uninformative about sources of funding so that people wouldn't know it was coming from British statecraft. And again, it's not just British statecraft. That was Nina Jankovic. That was the whole Michael Chertoff network. They work closely with the Atlantic Council, which is funded by 11 different U.S. governments, receives tens of millions of dollars in U.S. taxpayer funds. So the issue is the U.K., when it comes to Ukraine, has massive interests in Eurasia. When the Cold War ended, the U.K. expanded its portfolio deep into Eurasia, into the privatization of Russia and in the newly liberated post-Soviet Eastern European countries. And so there's a huge financial interest for London and for London banking portfolio companies to expand into Eurasia. And this is part of the British spider web there. They can't do it on their own. They need American muscle to make it happen. And this is why you see so much British statecraft focused on controlling U.S. domestic affairs to make sure the money keeps flowing to Ukraine and the boys keep sending their military support and their fighter jets and their drones to kill Russians. This great game has been playing out between the British and the Russians since the 1800s. We had a Crimean War before 2014. It happened in the mid-1800s. You can look that up. It's called The Great Game. This is the popular moniker for this contest between the Brits and the Russians over Eurasia. And the Americans have been used like pawns in this. Now, willing pawns, because so many American multinational companies and politicians get their donor support or get their revenues from the war profiteering. But the big loser here is the average U.S. taxpayer who doesn't see any of that money flow trickle down to them and instead is using their own income tax to subsidize war profiteers effectively a million miles away.
Let's rewind a little bit to the beginning of the Trump era, because you mentioned Russiagate and things like that. It's obviously, I don't need, you know, a lecture on why Hillary Clinton wanted to stop Donald Trump, but why was this international community, NATO itself, why were they all in on Trump? I realize why they might be now, but back then, it's not that he was an unknown guy, but politically he was relatively unknown, but it really seems like they went all in to stop Trump back then. Can you help me understand that?
Well, he broke the bipartisan consensus on foreign policy that had existed from Truman until Trump. You know, there was always this saying in Washington that politics stops at the water's edge, meaning we can disagree with each other over tax rates and abortion and, you know, health care, but we don't disagree party-wise when it comes to our foreign-facing foreign policy activities, what we're going to do vis-a-vis Russia, what we're going to do vis-a-vis China, what we're going to do vis-a-vis Iran and Venezuela. There are only a few times in U.S. history that there was a party line divide over foreign policy. I think probably the most famous one to this day is the Iran-Contra affair in the early 1980s with Nicaragua, when you had the Democrats pass something called the Bolin Amendment out of the House that barred U.S. taxpayer funds from going to overthrow the Sandinista government in Nicaragua. But the Republican Party, at the time, that was Ronald Reagan and George Bush Sr., wanted to overthrow the government in Nicaragua. And so they designed what they called the Enterprise, a private, self-sustained, off-the-shelf, standalone capacity to have the CIA and the National Security Council of the White House prop up covertly, without telling Congress, a regime change network and essentially narco gangs, military drug cartels to trading drugs for cash for guns to try to topple the Sandinista government with a violent paramilitary coup. And this led to a giant scandal when the Democrats found out about this and held a series of hearings. This was Ollie North, and everyone can look up the, you know, these famous congressional hearings. But that was a relatively small country with, frankly, not all that much economically on the line, Nicaragua. With Ukraine, you have trillions of dollars at stake here. A foreign policy divide could be disastrous to all the multinational companies, to all of the banks, to all of the foreign governments who have already started the process of skating towards where the puck was going. You have right now this situation, this dispute over the mineral resources in Ukraine. Ukraine sits on about $12 to $14 trillion worth of mineral and rare earth metal and oil and gas deposits that have not yet been mined and extracted. That is a literal, veritable gold mine that is just waiting to be plucked out of the earth. All manner of U.S. multinational companies and stakeholders want to get their hands on that. There's also the fact that Ukraine sits on that geopolitical pivot point between the East and the West. It is the center of the risk board, after all. And so it plays an enormous role in gatekeeping the flow of all energy resources into the 550 million people who live in the EU, who traditionally got their gas, their oil and gas from Russia. But if Ukraine can be made a solid NATO state and hold the line and box out Russian imports, then you cut off Russia, and then Russia goes bankrupt unless they have a lifeline from China, which they're now getting, to NATO's dismay. But if NATO were to be economically bankrupted that way, there goes all of the military resistance to the Pentagon all around the world. Right now, Russians are helping African countries do military coups against French and U.S. controlled governments. We saw just the final year of the Biden administration, I believe, four different governments in the Sahel that were controlled by U.S. and French proxies. I think this was Niger, Cote d'Ivoire, Chad, and I think one or two others were all ousted when Russian-backed African rebel forces, effectively, trained on by Russian special forces and supplied with Russian small arms, kicked the U.S. and French governments effectively out of power. That would not be possible if Russia was economically bankrupted because they had no export markets for their oil and gas. You may recall John McCain's saying that Russia is just an extended gas station with a military attached. And to some extent, they're not wrong about that. Although it is more than just oil and gas. They sit on $75 trillion worth of natural resources. This was the major aim of the 1990s in the privatization of Russia by the West, the selling off of the state-held assets to London and Wall Street. Putin reversed all of that when he took power in 1999 and began that process. But that war is still ongoing. And I think the point that I'm trying to drive home here is there will never be peace in Ukraine, not in our lifetime. There may be a peace deal struck, but the constant pressure to militarily build up Ukraine to one day take back the territories that were just lost in this war, and if that's obtained, to continue to push east, 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 ever eastward, is going to always be there. The temptation will be there in the same way that lust is a natural temptation of man, in the same way that greed and gluttony is a natural temptation of man. There will always be a native NATO desire to expand and seize those $75 trillion in Russia, to take Ukraine and Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan and the whole corridor until there's nothing left to be looted.
All right, we're going to take a quick time out right there. A little break. We'll be right back with more wisdom from Mike Benz. All right, Mike, just real quick before I let you go, I have to ask, do you take any stock in this? There were some ties to Ukraine and the Russia and the Trump assassination attempts. Do you put any stock in that at all? Do you consider that internet conspiracy theory nut jobness, or do you say there's something to it?
I think it's unclear currently. Certainly the ties, I think the story is much, much deeper and darker than what has been disclosed. Already what I've uncovered in this space, having done, you know, probably about 10 hours just of live stream lectures on the topic, Ryan Routh's involvement in Ukraine was frankly unbelievable versus how it's been covered. I mean, this was a guy who was recruiting violent terrorists and military extremists from Afghanistan and U.S.-trained Afghan special forces, from Pakistan, from Syria, from Iran, bringing them, collecting thousands and thousands and thousands of their passports, copies of their passports, in order to run them to the U.S. Embassy in Kiev to get them expedited passports to serve as human meat fodder in the cannons heading towards Russia in Ukraine. And the fact is that's CIA work. You can't do that as a civilian. Jesse, you and I can't just go over to Pakistan and recruit terrorists to bring them to Ukraine to get them no-look fast pass visas with the U.S. Embassy to get them to fight in a Pentagon war. I mean, the number of security clearance levels you're tripping in doing this, somebody had to be looking the other way during this, because the military has to be apprised of the recruiting effort. The CIA has to be apprised of that. They don't know who these fighters are. What if these fighters start firing on Ukrainians? What if they, what if there's some lack of cohesion with the Ukrainian troops? This needs to be vetted. And a homeless guy living in Hawaii with no assets to his name can't do that. You had a very strange episode in June 2023 when Customs and Border Patrol actually flagged Ryan Routh at the airport when he was returning from his whirlwind trip across Romania and Ukraine and Poland. He comes back home in Hawaii. He's flagged by Customs and Border Patrol because of the suspicious activity and the lack of an ability to give a straight answer. At the time, he gave Customs and Border Patrol a business card where he claimed to be the director of a 501c3 nonprofit in Ukraine, which gets into this Ukraine NGO network. Of course, something like 80 to 90% of the NGOs in Ukraine are funded by the U.S. government. Customs and Border Patrol then flags flags Ryan Routh to DHS to and saying, this guy looks suspicious. We want you to investigate this person. Now, DHS at the time was being run by Alejandro Mayorkas, you know, who was a scoundrel of the highest order, from everything from internet censorship to opening the border, to even having his own no-look fast-pass visa scandal. In 2015, the Inspector General of DHS, back when Mayorkas was the deputy DHS director for the Obama administration, Mayorkas was invested by his own Inspector General for what? For giving no-look fast-pass visas to political donors to the Democrat Party. And this is exactly what Ryan Routh was accused of doing, not only accused of doing, shown to be doing, in his own Facebook messages, where he provided receipts. He actually had a real-time chronological log of his effort to get no-look fast-pass visas, the very thing that the man in charge of DHS, supposed to be investigating him, was accused of doing by his own Inspector General. So every step of the way, he was flagged by CIA targeters like Sarah Adams. He was flagged by DHS. He was in communication with the U.S. Embassy in Kiev. He was doing CIA effective recruitment operations for terrorists to come to Ukraine. And that same person happens to be waiting at the, what, 12th hole of the Trump golf course to assassinate him with an automatic weapon. There's a reason, I think, that this case has been delayed. If folks remember the status update here, the Justice Department under the Biden administration requested an indefinite delay in the trial because of the complexity of the evidence. Well, what's so complex about the evidence here? How is it that he accumulated dozens of terabytes of a digital footprint, as somebody we're told barely could afford access to Wi-Fi? Who was he communicating with? What were on those encrypted chat apps that the FBI has control over the phones when they seized his phones and home electronics? To me, this is a story that needs immediate attention by Kash Patel and Pam Bondi, because my suspicion here is the reason that the Biden Justice Department has punted on this case, and you have not heard a peep since, formally requesting the judge to delay the trial so that they could draw it out the same way they've drawn out the JFK assassination, is because there are links here. The reason that he was allowed to go on and do this for so long in Ukraine, the reason he was allowed to operate the way that he did in the U.S., was because somebody deliberately looked the other way, or worse, was in communication with him the whole time he was planning to do this.
Mike, I really should have cut you off early. I shouldn't have asked that last question, because now I'm so unbelievably creeped out. I'm just freaked out at this point in time, Mike. You are the best, brother. Come back soon. I appreciate it. That is, wow, that's terrifying. Not surprising, but yeah, that's terrifying. Anyway, we're not quite done. Hang on. It is a tangled web, and you just heard all the stuff from Mike Benz. You heard me tell you about, you know, how we frame these things. Everything is World War II. It is not, but there are ugly things at play here, things that, honestly, if I'm being frank with you, I'm not 100% sure we all want to know the answer to. Now, I know you want to know. I want to know, but do we want to know? Do we really want to know why so many people are so intent on keeping this bloodletting going on forever? It's an ugly world out there. Anyway, keep yourself in prayer. We'll do it again.
This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.